Yeah, I think we'll, I think we'll get going. We have an interesting, interesting subject today on Saudi. Last night we talked on rather macro issues, comparative advantage, new trade theory. I was surprised how many people were here for business class. Today we're going to kind of step down from a macro way of looking at the world to actually implementation and globalization and international trade. So today we're going to do a piece on Saudi, and tomorrow we're going to do some globalization in Japan. So that is construct under this umbrella of globalization. I'm going to talk about some of my own experiences in Saudi Arabia. It's a country that continues to be in the news. As you know, the folks on the airplanes in 9/11 were Saudis, and they also subsequently blew up apartment complex in Riyadh, which is the capital, and are a major influence in the Middle East in funding various causes, some beneficial, not so beneficial. My hope is that my first-hand anecdotes provide some insights into being in the kingdom. It's not an easy place to get to. You can't go there. You have to be invited. If you're Muslim, you get to go there on the Hajj. Right? But otherwise than that, if you're a Westerner, if you're an infidel, you have to be invited. And anybody been to Saudi in here?
I haven't even been invited.
You haven't
been invited? Never been there.
Okay. So going back to former life, again, I'm Kit Nagel. Faculty at Concordia College in New York, and I teach international management, INS, international studies, and things like that. But in the corporate world, I have a background in dairy and juice processing and packaging that has taken me around the world. And that's how I got to Saudi Arabia. As I said, Saudi, there are no tourist visas to Saudi. And it's security in Saudi is so tight, not only to get the visa in, you have to get a visa to leave. Okay, and I'll try and be balanced here, but it's a relief to leave. In the expatriate community that lives in Saudi, they live in compounds, they help run the infrastructure, they help run the oil business, this is not very politically correct, but they wear t-shirts that says, "Happiness is a Saudi exit visa." the ruling monarchy, the House of Ibn Saud, on the Arabian Peninsula is especially nervous about security because their legitimacy is tied with their responsibility for maintaining the sanctity and security of the two of the three major holy sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina. Security is tight, and there really is almost no crime in Saudi. There's a lot of white-collar crime, but there's not a lot of street crime or violent crime in Saudi. And this is something that the Saudis really quite proud of. But the pendulum has perhaps swung a bit too far. And I talked about this previously. Under Sharia law, there are various prescribed punishments, and certain punishments you get publicly flogged for. Certain crimes you get beheaded for. Certain crimes you get limbs cut off for. Certain crimes, if you're a woman, you get stoned for. And it's an indictment on our political system, it's an indictment on our media that we pick up and cover under Sharia law when women are condemned to be stoned in where? Nigeria, or where, Pakistan or where, Iran, okay, but it's not covered in the media when women are sentenced and stoned in Saudi Arabia. People, every week, women are stoned to death in Saudi Arabia. Okay, does it make the news? Does it make the news?
No.
Does not.
Do they allow journalism?
Do they
allow it out?
I've personally been invited to a stone, so people know. Obviously, I didn't go. Okay, but the media is controlled, but the American media knows that this is going on, and they're not reporting the sort of realpolitik, and that's an indictment. Well, I'm not going to go there. I guess I just did go there. But I wanted to, anyway, on the Saudis are very proud of their, that there is very little crime in Saudi, and that's true. And one of the Saudis I was working with said that, you know, if you're running a shop in the bazaar and somebody comes in and their right hand is missing, you know you should watch that person, okay, because they're a thief. Anyway, given the level of control of the foreigners, it's really troubling to the Saudis that they were and have been unable to control the extremists within their own community. There have been bombings inside Saudi, and you only get to be in Saudi if you're a Saudi citizen or have gone through very rigorous security. And, you know, again, where I started, the 9/11 folk in the plane were Saudis. The people that blew up the towers in Riyadh were Saudis. The Saudis have come down very hard on Al-Qaeda in the kingdom, and a lot of due process in the kingdom. But the Al-Qaeda, which one of their goals is to oust the House of Saud, which they call infidel, and there's a huge rift between the bin Laden family and the House of Ibn Saud. Because of the wealth of the country, Saudi imports labor from around the world. It would be an overstatement to say that the Saudis don't work, but it's correct that those that work in Saudi are not Saudis. Well, you might show up in an office, you know, and get paid. But the people who are actually running stuff and maintaining things and pumping oil and cleaning the streets are not Saudis. Okay. There's a pecking order among the foreign nationals. There's 26 million people in Saudi. About 6 million of those are foreign workers. And there's a pecking order, that's a bad term, but there's a pecking order among the foreign nationals. At the top are Europeans and Americans, engineers, managers, that see to the production in that country and the infrastructure of the country. Also, almost to that level are very capable Arab business folk, Egyptians and Palestinians. And yes, Palestinians who have within the Arab world a great tradition of education and business savvy, which I found to be very true. And another indictment on our media, it's no shocker, U.S. media tends to portray the Palestinians as a violent, dependent, almost incompetent people, relegated to the refugee camps in Gaza, and have been led by flawed individuals throughout their history. And that's the image portrayed in the Western media. But actually, the majority of Palestinians live in Jordan, and they live in Egypt, and many are highly educated. And I worked with a Palestinian engineering manager in Saudi, a guy called Khaled Abu Saad, and I liked him a lot, and he liked me a lot. I also have a number of Israeli friends, and separately, they have told me that they consider the Palestinians to be the elite of the Arab world. Is this the image we see in the New York Times? I don't think so. Next down the pecking order, after Europeans and Americans and Egyptians, who are very good business folk, and the Palestinians, Then we come workers in such middle tier countries as the Philippines, worked with some good Philippine engineers, draftsmen. And then at the bottom are, or toward the bottom are Pakistanis, and the absolute bottom of the pecking order are Bangladesh. And so the imported workers from Bangladesh get the most menial jobs. They sweep the streets, clean the toilets and the sewers. Okay. In Saudi, there is a civil judicial system with which if you are arrested for a crime, you're going to be okay. There's a civil system that isn't too bad. However, there is a parallel religious judicial system that they can arrest you, they can try you, and they can imprison you, and you will disappear. And people regularly do disappear. There's not freedom, there's not political freedom in the country. And once the religious agents have taken you, even the police cannot go get you, even the civil police cannot save you. In addition to getting into trouble with the civil or religious courts, a further control by the royal family is that it does not allow political dissent, and there are special jails for just political jails. And I've driven past them, and they're in the desert, and it's like a very long building, one story high, and it's about 11 stories deep. It's underground, and that's what political dissidents get to live in. And it's also illegal to show disrespect of the royal family. Also in Thailand, actually, it's illegal to show disrespect. If you deface the currency in Thailand, has a picture of the king, that's a crime. And the people take that seriously in Thailand. They take their royalty seriously. In Saudi, less so. And so the royal family is very sensitive, and you can go to prison for simply making jokes about them. Though it's interesting, in private conversation, many people do. And the current head of Saudi is Abdullah, but his brother, King Fahd, the late King Fahd, was, people were told, sort of, he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, and so they tell kind of those kind of jokes. And one day, King Fahd, this is true, he decided to expand his title from simply king. King wasn't enough. So he said, okay, I'm going to be king, and my titles now include caretaker of the holy cities. And the joke plays on the word caretaker, which in translation, again, even in English, but the word caretaker also can be translated as janitor. Okay. So the line of the joke, and it's not funny, but it's funny if it's told hushed, and you go to jail if you tell it, it gets really funny. So the line of the joke is, the day after King Fahd gave himself the expanded title, all right, as king and caretaker of the holy cities, he was seen outside the Bangladesh embassy waiting in line to change his citizenship. A variation of the same joke plays on the symbol of the House of Saud, which is crossed swords and a palm tree. Okay. On the Saudi flag, you know, typically in many Muslim countries, let's say Libya and so forth, Pakistan, it's a green flag. Okay, and the Saudi flag has a sword on it, and it also has the Shahada, which is, you know, the great saying of Islam. There is one God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Anyway, the Saudi flag is these cross swords under a palm tree. And the line is, the day after King Fahd gave himself the expanded title of King Caretaker of the Holy Cities, the symbol on the flag over the palace had changed. Now the palm trees were inverted into a mop and a bucket. It's actually sedition to talk this way, and these jokes are in a very quiet voice, and I'd been there quite some time before people would kind of be leaning over and be telling me these jokes. And the second joke, we're telling it, and the person at the table over started listening to the joke, and Khaled just shut up. I mean, it's so funny, it's not funny. You'll have problems. My friend Khaled and I were involved with a large dairy processing plant in Saudi Arabia called Al Safi. Al Safi in Arabic means the pure, and is owned by Prince Abdullah. Again, there are about 1,800, 1,900 princes in Saudi. And Khaled's business group was doing the cooling and refrigeration work, and this is a very large operation. And my company, we were doing the design, build, upgrade. And this is on a dairy operation about an hour and a half outside of Riyadh. And what, you may be asking, what on earth is a dairy operation doing in the middle of a desert? And Riyadh is smack right in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula. It's fierce, they call that land the Anvil of God. The sun comes down and it hits. Okay. So do you think Elsie likes it there in the middle of the desert? But it's a fascinating piece. And so we were doing a design upgrade on it. And where do you think the largest dairy operations are in the U.S.? Where do you think?
Midwest.
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's a good answer.
California
is the answer. Okay. And people in Wisconsin are loath to admit it, but California is the dairy state. Sorry.
Really?
They produce more milk and cheese in California, and they have very large, efficient dairy herds, large of which in California is 15,000 cows. 15. Question?
I'm sorry, are we talking about CAFOs or?
Talking about cows?
Yeah, no, I know. Like, are we talking about factory farms or?
Yeah, corporate.
Corporate, big, huge farms.
Right. Yeah. I mean, is there a place to graze in real? That's what I'm asking.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay,
because you can't graze in the desert.
That's what I'm saying.
Nothing.
No, <what I'm> saying.
Eat rocks. So. Anyways, that's a lot of cows. And so the largest dairy herd in California has 15,000 cows. Well, the world's largest dairy operation in the world is Al Safi, and they have 29,000 cows. Okay, that's a lot of cows. Again, it's no bulls. It's all cows.
It's all girls.
It's all girls.
You have to wear a veil.
It's an extreme heat, and we'll get to the rationale for this, but they milk, anybody know of what a dairy farm looks like? I spent a lot of time on dairies, you know? Okay, know what a dairy farm looks like.
Sometimes.
You know what a big old Holstein looks like. It's a big animal, right? It's a big production animal. And the good thing about cows, heifers, are they're mild-mannered, they're placid. Bulls, anybody been around a bull? A bull will try and kill you. No ifs, and I mean, it will try and kill you. And so, actually, I'm going a little field here, but in the dairy business around the world, if you're born male, you know, it's a 50-50 split at birth, okay, you're going to become veal if you're male. So if you're eating veal, it's a male. Anyway, so they milk 120 cows every 12 minutes. Okay, so we're not talking a nice rural scene of Connecticut, you know, farmer's got 300 cows, knows this one by name. So they're milking 120 cows every 12 minutes, 24/7. Okay. The cows live in shaded areas under special water spray fans, misters, they're made in Arizona. And they can lower the temperature about 20 degrees to about 80 degrees F, which is about the tolerance level for any lactating animal is about 80. And like all the technology in Saudi Arabia, I mean all the technology, it's imported. Okay. So this is why Saudi is such an interesting place, and there's a lot of business in Saudi, is because Saudi does these kind of projects.
What do they feed the cows? I keep thinking desert when I think Saudi Arabia.
Well, you should. Okay. What they use, the farm complex, again, if you've got 30,000 cows, you got to feed them, right? You got to feed them silage, you got to feed them something. And so the farm complex uses center pivot irrigation. And when you fly over the western United States, you see these big circles of green. That's exactly what they do in Saudi. And so they have huge circular fields that grow alfalfa, sorghum, and hay. And
the water comes from
mile deep wells. And given the dry air and evaporation, the farm uses a huge amount of water comes up. And the water comes to surface, not boiling, but really, really hot. And actually needs to be cooled. So Khaled has a huge cooling system to cool the well water before it's put on the central pivot system. And cooling, this would make such agriculture totally uneconomical in the United States. But guess what? Energy is free in Saudi, right? So all these major projects, energy is not an issue. Okay, so if you need water to have central pivot irrigation and it's too hot, well, you just cool it. And actually, all these crops now and evaporating water have started to change the climate, and occasionally clouds have been seen on the interior of the Arabian Peninsula that have never been seen in history, and quite remarkable. Now, having an operation like this in the middle of the desert, okay, when there is a global surplus of commodity milk powder, there's actually a surplus of milk in the world. Okay, that's why we make a lot of powder in the United States. A lot of Europeans make powder. South Americans make powder. You store it. You sell it. It's a surplus commodity. It goes into bread. It goes into all kinds of things we eat. And so this is not a rational economic project to enter into, okay? Because the Saudis could simply import milk powder, reconstitute it with water, add some fats, add some vitamins, and you'd have reconstituted milk. And we're, in the US, we're fortunate in that we have just superb milk quality. We drink fresh milk. Very few people in the world actually drink fresh milk. It's some kind of processed milk or canned milk or UHT, long life milk. And when you reconstitute milk, you can get really close flavor-wise to the original, and you can get to the same place nutrition-wise with powder. So, with the Saudis, if it were just a pure economic piece, they would be importing powder, reconstituting it, making a drinking logo called Laban or other dairy products. So it just makes no economic sense, but it's still a great business opportunity for companies like my old company with companies in Europe or Scandinavia or in Arizona to come and build these things. And why, the question begs the question, why would you do this? And the dairy is a product of a panic from 1973. 1973 was the oil embargo, and oil went from about 32 cents a barrel to about $3.30 a barrel. Now that sounds cheap, and it is cheap. You know, going from 32 to $3. But if your whole economy is based on $32 per barrel oil, a 10-to-1 order of magnitude, it was a hell of a shock. Remember? I know. I remember that time. I was younger then, but I remember the time. They used the oil embargo against the Western nations, and the Saudi family looked around this and they said, people, if they get really angry at us, what are they going to do? They're going to, what's our Achilles heel? and the Achilles heel of Saudi Arabia was food. They didn't produce any food. And so they got in a panic and they said, we have to produce food. So the king declared the kingdom was going to be self-sufficient in its food supply. Okay, and it didn't matter what it cost. Okay, and everybody else around the world is paying them, you know, $3, $4, $5, $10 per barrel now, and paying for them to become independent in food production. Kingdom also decided they wanted to grow wheat in the desert, and that after spending billions, they figured out you really can't do that. But they tried. They really tried.
Question about the farm?
Yeah.
How about all the waste from 30,000 cows?
That is a big place. That is a big place.
So they're not.
They're not making, using it intelligently. No, they're not making energy. Methane. The Chinese do make methane. Makes gas, and they provide gas to a number of cities in China to do that. But the Saudis don't need energy. They don't need the methane. I mean, they burn it. You know, they just flame it off when it's at the refinery. Okay. So they decided, okay, how are we going to do this? So they just provided huge subsidies to import irrigation equipment and grow crops. And they said, we're going to pay the freight for milk cows from Europe and the United States. Okay. And I was working for a company called Servrite International, but I also was working in tandem with the U.S. Holstein Association and was involved with a large shipment of Holsteins to Saudi Arabia. And I remember taking my oldest son, Jonathan, when he was younger, he was like in junior high, took him to JFK Airport, and because these, since price is no object, the Saudis were flying in heifers. Okay, these are bred heifers, and we would get about 300 bred heifers on a 747. Literally, it was a FedEx, and it's one of those huge suckers where the whole nose comes up. Okay. And they had some bad experience when the animals became agitated, poking holes at 30 in the side of the fuselage, which is rather thin at 30,000 feet, is detrimental. So what they did, it was kind of cool. They had very lightweight pens that would hold about four or five cows, and they're all bred heifers, so they're younger cows, and then you have a bunch of these pens going into this cavernous plain, and occasionally they will fly a bull. They don't like to fly bulls because bulls, I don't know what it is. Bulls are nasty. I've had bulls trying and get me, and I've been a little bit quicker and closer to the fence. But bulls will try, and so I mean the safety of being a dairy farmer is skyrocketed in the last half century because you don't need a bull anymore. You have all artificial insemination, but sometimes heifers, they call it, I'm not being silly, they call it natural service. Sometimes the artificial doesn't work and you need a bull. And so occasionally they'll fly a bull, and they hate to do it because bulls are nasty. And I was talking with the vet, and when you're flying across the world, they fly a vet with all the animals, make sure they're okay. And I said, well, why don't you sedate the bull? Like I'm smart, why don't you just, give him happy pills or something? And he said, that's the thing. Sometimes when you give a sedative to a bull, it'll calm him down. Sometimes when you give a sedative to a bull, it'll make him really mad. So it's not so they don't like to fly the bulls. But they're bred heifers, okay, so they'll get to Saudi, and within 3 or 4 weeks, about a month, they'll have the cow, they'll drop the calf, and they'll be in milk immediately, right? And then they can be milked. Okay. And at this dairy operation in Al Safi, the plant managers were from England and Ireland, who were very good taking care of animals. But they had laborers from over 22 countries. Amazing global, talk about globalization, right? 22 countries, and many from India and Nepal. And whenever a cow has to be, the euphemism is put down, they would have to tell all the Hindu workers why they were doing this, and they had to, and they would do it respectfully. A cow has a a certain productive life, mm-hmm. and all the male calves, they were en route to becoming veal. So, just in your mind's eye, consider the scale of this operation: 30,000 animals in the middle of the desert. Okay, totally uneconomic construct, and yet, from a political point of view. And a sort of macro strategic point of view, that's what the Saudis do. They can't do it themselves, so they pay and they buy the best technology and the best competence from around the world. Another crazy project that the Saudis almost funded, and it's good that they didn't, had to do with the ever-present shortage of fresh water. And the very modern capital city of Riyadh, again, it's right in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula, is a modern city, but it has one of those feels to it, almost like a ghost town or a transient place, quite fragile. And the minute that the oil goes, that place is going to be tumble and tumbleweeds. I mean, it's going to be nothing there. It's very modern. But Saudi has a huge issue on the shortage of fresh water. And they operate a lot of desalination plants. And these are interesting, again, because energy is free. Okay. So a desalination plant, these things are huge, and they're called cogeneration. So they'll have a large plant that will be producing a lot of heat, will be turning gas turbines to provide power and electricity, but also producing a lot of heat, and then they use that heat to, condense, boil, condense, desal the water. The use of energy is massive, but the cost doesn't matter because Saudis have unlimited energy. And the thinking was, and it was one of the princes that thought this up, and this was actually a serious approach that almost got built, was to create a massive series of cooling coils and grids in the shallow coastal waters of the Red Sea. The Red Sea is that sea that runs up on the west coast of Saudi. And so they were going to cool the Red Sea. Okay. And the rationale for cooling the Red Sea was that at air masses coming off of Africa, okay, would go over the Red Sea, would pick up some moisture, okay, and then on the coastal waters, if they could cool the Red Sea, okay, that would induce precipitation on the west coast of Saudi in Jeddah. Can you imagine the scope of a project to cool the Red Sea? The energy usage would have been unimaginable. The environmental impact would have been crazy. But only Saudi Arabia could get serious, and they were serious about cooling the. I mean, another project.
Before you get into that, the question about the water.
Yeah.
You said they drill deep wells for the water for irrigation.
Right.
Are they driving down the water table?
Yes, they are.
Fast. The aquifer is going.
Aquifer is just keep going, just like we're doing in Nebraska with mm-hmm. People are with U.S. government subsidies, for corn and ethanol. Farmers that were growing wheat are now growing corn, and we I mean, corn requires much more water than wheat. And the aquifers in Nebraska are going down, and that's through government subsidy. That's a real issue. The Al Safi project was cool. I really enjoyed that. I was not involved with the Red Sea one. I was involved with another project that actually ultimately didn't get built. And again, this, what I'm trying to portray is sort of these anecdotes of life on the scale of the Saudi thinking. And this one didn't get built, but this would have been the largest automated flash freezing and meat storage facility on the planet. And I'd never done one of those before, so I thought that was pretty cool. And this was to be built in Mecca, okay? And would be used 1 month a year during Hajj, and to process and store the carcasses of the animals sacrificed during Hajj. Okay. The Hajj, each adult male is expected. Women go on Hajj, but it's each adult male who is able and can afford it is expected to go on Hajj once in their lifetime. And they're expected to sacrifice a healthy animal, preferably by tradition a sheep. Well over 1 million animals are slaughtered during the 3 days of High Hajj. 1 million animals. Okay. And most of these animals are imported. I mean, it's just like the Old Testament. Okay. Over and over the years, more Muslims have been getting wealthier and are going on the Hajj. And the religious authorities saw this really getting out of hand. They couldn't handle all this sacrificing. So they made a rule, the religious folk made a rule, that if you sacrificed a cow, it would count for 5 sheep. Okay. And so 5 pilgrims could go in on the price of a cow. And the price of a cow is... So it'd be cheaper if you go and buy a cow than buying 5 sheep, okay? And we're not talking about, you know, nice Elsie cow, you know, we're talking about a broken down old lady.
Do they retire Elsie to
Elsie does take a trip, yes, she does take a trip. So you kill one animal and then you'd have the Hajj sacrifice obligation taken care of. And this is... you know, the U.S. is actually very, very good at meat processing. We're very good at automation, and so I was working with some companies in the U.S. to get this going. And then we had a further specification. They also thought, well, we also have a lot of old camels around here. Okay, so why don't we use them for sacrifice? And let's see, we'll calculate it that a camel is worth 7 sheep. So people could go in, buy one animal, and it would count. They'd kill the one animal and count for 7 folk for the Hajj. The Hajj is a big deal. It's one of the fifth major precepts of the Muslim faith. As you know, the precepts are known as the 5 pillars of Islam. Also, the third pillar is zakat. Zakat is almsgiving or giving to the poor. You are supposed to give a portion of what you have to the needy. It's an honorable thing. And, you know, anything that you can do to lessen the burden of the needy is honorable. And as part of this tradition, the meat from the Hajj, the meat from the sacrificed animals, is not to be wasted, okay, but needs to be distributed for consumption to family, friends, and poor and needy people in the community, okay. As there are no poor people in Saudi, much of the meat had to be frozen and then exported. It would be exported to other Islamic countries and given to the poor in those countries. So, if you have 1 million animals, just think of it. Next Thursday, Holden Village is going to slaughter 1 million animals, okay, and then we're going to freeze them. How are we going to do that? Okay. Anyway, the funding for the project, which came through the Islamic Development Bank, fell through. They redirected that project funding to another. But it was really an enlightening experience for me, and just to engineer this thing and these designers in the United States. And as I said, the U.S. has great capacity, capability, automated systems, but they'd never seen anything of this order of magnitude. And it was interesting working out the logistics of this thing, because Americans are used to, you know, butchering sheep. We know how to do that. We know how to butcher sheep and hogs. We know how to butcher cows. We don't know how to butcher camels. So, and all, you know, these CAD, computer system design systems, you know, you help you design, and you have these overhead rails that are carrying the carcasses of, you know, the sheep. We know how to do that. Pigs, we know how to do that. We're going to size this cow. Yeah, we can do that. Well, after you've killed the camel, what are the dimensions of a slaughtered camel? And they didn't have that in the CAD system. So we had to specially do a thing in Saudi where we had to go kill a camel, and then we had to hang it up. And you know, a camel is a weird thing. I mean, think of those legs. I mean, you know, it's the weirdest thing. So anyway, these guys in Iowa, they were stunned. You know, they were working on this thing that's going to be hanging upside down and you know, old legs. We didn't build that thing. Okay. But this is some of the fun of international business. You know, doing getting guys in Iowa to, you know, do a design of a template for slaughtered camels. You know, I mean, out of thing. Finally, I'd like to close with an example of the theory that there are less than 4 degrees of separation between any two people on Earth. Sometimes people say it's 3. And this is between me and Saddam Hussein. Okay, so there's one person in between me and Saddam Hussein. I never met him. But I think it's indicative of dictatorships and autocrats from this story. But my Palestinian friend, Khaled, he was working for a Saudi company and did refrigeration throughout the kingdom. He also did refrigeration and air conditioning for one of Saddam's grand palaces, and this was before Gulf War I. Okay. And Ghalib and his crew had completed their contracted work and wanted to go back to Saudi because that's where their families were, that's where they live. But the contract on this huge palace needed a final inspection and sign-off, and they needed that sign-off by a specific colonel who was responsible for the operation of Saddam's palaces. Okay, and weeks went by, and they said, "Well, he'll come next week." No, he didn't come. Well, he's up, you know, another week. Well, he's up country. He didn't come. And Khaled figured out why he was always away on one or on a special assignment. It was clear that the Iraqi colonel was afraid to sign off on the air conditioning work, which was quite rational, fear, understandable, because if there were any problems with the air conditioning when Saddam used the palace, the colonel would be taken out back and shot. Not very tolerant. So Ghalib and his crew waited and waited. And then one day Saddam showed up at the palace, and he was in a good mood, which was a good thing that day. And he noticed Ghalib and asked him, "What are you doing here?" And Ghalib explained that their work was complete, but they needed someone to approve it. And Saddam smiled, and he gave Ghalib a big hug. Now, this is a dangerous thing. Sometimes Saddam would hug people in the morning and have them shot in the afternoon. So this wasn't necessarily a good thing. But from Ghalib's point of view, Saddam has said he'd done a good job, and that he could now go home. That was explicitly said, he could now go home. So naturally, that was all the approval anyone needed. Okay. But everybody's standing around Hussein kind of shaking. A further twist to this episode is that Saddam Hussein also brought in the general contractor for the whole palace, said that Khaled's company had done a really good job, and they should receive a 10% bonus above and beyond what their contract said, and that the contractor themselves were going to have to pay the bonus. It wasn't going to be an increase in payment from Saddam. So the general contractor was surprised, but Saddam was there, so of course agreed. And so the next day, Ghalib and his crew, about 20 folks, you know, they just can't wait to get out of Dodge. They're all packed and they're set to go. And Ghalib goes up to the contractor's office to collect the bonus. And they sat down on opposite sides of a table, and the contractor looked Ghalib, imagine this, face off, looked Ghalib right in the eye, and he put a very large envelope on one side of the table, okay? And then he reached down and put a gun, 9mm, on the other side of the table. And he said, there is your bonus if you think you should take it. But you should know that it's a long way from here to the border. And Ghalib said, well, we don't need the bonus. And wisely left, because he would not have made it to, and I wouldn't have had that. I still stay in touch with Ghalib, he's a friend. So these are little slices of doing business in Saudi Arabia, some insights into how business is done there. We don't have a frame of reference to how we do business in the West and how business is done in Saudi. So, yes?
You haven't touched on their method of financing things and interest and stuff like this, which they don't charge, I understand.
Right. I haven't touched on that. I may touch on that Friday, but right now under Sharia law, under Sharia law, you can't charge interest and you can't have a mortgage, and so you have to finesse things very carefully. But that is true. That is true. Yeah.
Is Sharia the same from country to country, or does it vary?
It does vary, and we should always remember that Sharia is not Quranic. It's tradition that has evolved, and some of Sharia is based on the Quran, but it's not the word of the Prophet. It comes from, it's a step away from it.
Is it at all comparable to Talmud?
Never mind. That's a good question. But to your question, Sharia law is not the same in all countries. Also, there's like Orthodox Sharia, which is the sort of Wahhabi, virulent, harsh Sharia. And then other countries have some parts of their civil or penal code will reflect Sharia, but not the extreme parts of Sharia. So just because you're a Muslim country doesn't mean you are strongly enforcing religious Sharia. Like Turkey is an Islamic Muslim country, but is also a very secular country. And so you're not going to see women being stoned, and you're not going to see people having body parts cut off in Turkey. Turkey's a very civilized country. It's a sleeper country. I'm very impressed with it. Yeah.
If they're importing all this labor to do all these things, what about the young people? And I understand the education there is very good, so what happens to the young people who are getting educated?
Right. This is under the heading of the curse of oil. You look around the countries, except for the enlightened Norwegians. Look around the world to the countries that have oil, and they're screwed up. Okay, look at Venezuela. You know, Hugo Chavez. I mean, you know, insane asylum material. Saudis, Iraqis. They are. You take away the need for entrepreneurial drive. take away the need to be smart, to think on your feet. Okay. So you have countries with great resources, hydrocarbons, and they're not really developing an entrepreneurial middle class, which is vital. Whereas other countries, you could look at Japan, or you can look at Singapore, or you can look at Switzerland, that each of us have no natural resources, and yet have very high standard of living, have a vibrant middle class, very good education. So there's very little for the Saudis, the Saudi youth to do. And they become, either they'll go party in Europe, or they'll become somewhat radicalized by the Wahhabis and fly airplanes into buildings in the U.S. I'm being simplistic here, but the curse of oil is very real. Yeah.
Have you seen the Saudi Arabia World magazine?
I have not.
It's a free publication. It's well done.
I have not seen it.
It's free. Just fill out a card and send it in. You get it every month.
Is it by the Saudis?
It's by the Aramco.
Okay. So it's an organ of the...
Yeah, it's a little bit of propaganda, but it's pretty interesting.
Any other questions about... Yes.
What did they do with all the animals from the Hajj now that they didn't hear...
Oh, they didn't? Yeah. They ultimately built a thing. It was much scaled down. And so... They didn't go all the way with the camels, and so they decided to import more sheep, which are easier to handle, much more. But they, Hajj continues to go on, and sacrifice continues to go on. But just the scale of things in the kingdom is amazing. Yeah.
If people are trying to decrease dependence on Saudi oil, then what happens, if theoretically, we are able to do that, and then they don't have any other. Are they trying to develop something to support that? If for some reason the world economy isn't so dependent on them, it seems like they'd crumble.
They've made efforts to diversify their economy. They're forward integrating into petrochemicals, and they're doing the cracking at a big complex north of Jeddah. Nothing like. Could replace the crude, but they're without the oil trade, we're tumbling tumbleweeds, and that speaking perfectly as a as American, that would be fine. If we can wean ourselves off hydrocarbons, let's do it. Yeah.
Another question. You mentioned a couple of times that the male calves are used for veal, but don't they make any of the steers and use them for hamburger or something?
Well, they don't get to live that long. Insemination is artificial. So there's a huge business in genetics in the dairy business. And so you can eat veal or you can have a goat burger in Saudi, but... No, they don't live that long. It's expensive. I mean, it's prohibitively expensive to just keep a cow in milk, let alone let a calf, live to maturity. Yeah. Any other questions about the dairy business?
Do you still drink milk?
Yeah. U.S. milk is the best in the world, I'm one who knows. And we have the USDA, the pasteurized milk ordinance, so milk you drink is first rate. I've been places where it's not, but in the U.S. it's excellent.
We do something right then.
Oh, we do a lot of stuff right.
It's true.
I do that. Well, thank you very much.